Jason Pica, the second attorney and mediator. Welcome to Lunch and a Divorce Lawyer, Jason.
Hey, Peter. Thanks for having me.
So grateful to have you. So, Jason, I'll tee you up here. So what do you do?
Well, at my new firm, I've been here since the beginning of September. We primarily are practicing high asset, high profile, typically more complex divorce law.
Cool.
So in other words, we divorce people typically with a good amount of money.
Sure thing. And you're also, are you still continuing your mediation practice?
I sure am. Yes.
So we're taping this in the middle of January, 2023. Give us some of the crumbs on your journey or something. I don't know. That's my Hansel and Gretel analogy, but you know, here's where you are today doing this high end divorce stuff and mediation, family law. How did you end up there?
So
what's your story?
I go back to when I was born. My parents divorced when I was less than 1 year old, or maybe right around the time that I was one. But it wasn't far after that. Divorced, their marriage wasn't too long. It was a couple years. So in other words, they didn't have much to argue about in terms of the finances, but they did have two children. I was the youngest. So for 18 years, though, until I was 18, they did have parentage related litigation. My biological parents' litigation included me having two different GALs. I had supervised visits as a child, supervised visits both in public and in a conference room. That was back when a supervised visit wasn't too therapeutic. You know, I can remember it being quite odd being in a very basic room in a conference room as a child younger than 10, sitting at a conference room table with one of my parents and a person that I didn't know. So their litigation also included my dad having a sober link, him having a blow before turning on his car, right? My mom had mental health challenges. So with their two different lifelong challenges, that created complex parentage litigation for 18 years. And then my mom remarried, and she was married for 20 years. She got a divorce. My biological dad was previously married for 16 years as well, and then he got a divorce. So I always tell everyone that by the time I graduated undergrad, I had lived through three divorces, neither of them being my own. So I really don't know what it's like to go a day without talking about the illegalities of a divorce or how divorce affects you. And then lo and behold, I've been working for a divorce attorney since I was 15 or 16. I got the opportunity to be a runner, as we used to call it, for a group of attorneys. It was a group of maybe 10 attorneys in Wisconsin. Two or three of them were divorce attorneys. And I can't really figure out the reason yet, but I really gravitated toward the divorce attorneys. And ever since then, in undergrad, I worked for a nonprofit law firm. I worked for legal aid. I worked under a judge in domestic relations in Cook County. And then I worked at a very high asset divorce office. Then I went back to legal aid, and now I'm here. So I've had quite the divorce journey, but I've never been divorced myself.
Are you a Wisconsin native, or what were you doing in Wisconsin?
I am Wisconsin native, a Racine.
Oh, really? Interesting. Yep. Underrated part of Wisconsin. I think it gets a bad rap. It's got nice lakefront and inexpensive real estate on the lake.
You know, that is one way to think about it. I'm actually going back to my high school. I think it's a month from today to give a presentation. to everyone. So hopefully I can recruit more divorce lawyers. Who knows?
That's cool. Yeah, for somebody who, you know, we're not talking about age and stuff here, but I don't think you're 75. You have a lot of like personal like connection to family law. I mean, that's kind of incredible. I feel like I hear a lot of people right in my life as a divorce lawyer as well, doing this podcast. Hey, I went through a divorce and this motivated me to get in there, but I'm not sure I've ever had somebody with the detailed background of being a runner for divorce lawyers, but probably more intimately having experienced supervised visitation and the participant, if you will, not participant, but beneficiary of or something of SoberLink.
Yep. And I forgot to include that there was a custody eval as well when I was a child. So basically, if a judge can order it, I've been affected by it.
Wow. I mean, that's got to give you like a perspective that very few attorneys have. I mean, right? I mean, it's like I can talk about it, but I have experienced on your side that you're discussing, what would you say, the client or the child side? I think none of those things.
Right. I try to give a little bit of more intimate advice when I'm representing a parent in a case that's primarily about the children. I don't always give it depending on who the client is, right? If I have the intuition that the client might take advantage of knowing more intimate details about who I am, then I don't necessarily give it. But if it's the right client, then yes, I have no problem. I'm pretty much an open book about my childhood and how I got where I am today. But that's also a reason why I would one day like to be on the GAL list.
Well, that's awesome. Yeah, I look at your background and your bio, and we'll talk about it more. And I was actually going to ask you. It seems like you're a logical fit to get on there and represent kids, because yeah, I would think they would be particularly appreciative of, hey, this isn't just some joker adult like telling me what to do. Rather, it's someone who's basically been in my shoes X number of years ago and knows exactly what I'm going through. Therefore, you know. Right. I mean, so many relationships, child, you know, it's like trust, right? I mean, so many relationships are based on like, can you trust this person? They might be an expert, but like, if there's not like empathy, trust, some like commonality or something, it's like, you know.
Great. And actually last month I did the CVLS child rep training. So now I can complete 3 volunteer GAL cases. And then after you complete those, it's more of a fast track, if you will, to the application to apply to be on the GAL list. So
that's cool. I'm on the list, and it's been a minute since I did it. So I don't know if it's changed since COVID. I mean, what was it? I remember talking to some panel or something with the chief judge of domestic relations or something, and eventually they gave me the yay. And I know there's some. What did you have to practice maybe 10 years with a specialization in family law or something, but
something like that. Yeah.
I think you're a solid fit. So if you need a reference, I'm your guy.
Thank you. Fast track that a little.
No, CVLS is solid. And on the user side of supervised visitation, I mean, is it awful? What's the best way to structure it? We're going on a little bit of a tangent than the agenda I gave you, but I'm totally curious. Cause I mean, there are 2 or 3 different flavors, I feel like, of supervised parenting time when you get it ordered in a case.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, how would you structure it if you're the 7-year-old? And I don't know how old you were when you were doing it, but what would a kid enjoy?
That's
or find cool. most meaningful?
I can't. I would have to go back to my parents' divorce documents. You know, so P.S.
Yes.
When I... a couple years ago when I was in my JD program, but also in my MSW program, I was in the MSW before JD, but at the time of grad school getting the MSW, I was also working for a divorce lawyers. And I could always tell along the way that you know, parents tend to, at least in these types of cases, create narratives that are for their best interests so that mm-hmm. the kids are happier with their narrative. So, you know, I learned along the way that parents tend to do that. So I ended up getting all of my parents' divorce documents from Racine County in Wisconsin. I looked at them all. And of course, when I looked at them objectively, both of them were not 100% telling the truth. So I have to go back to those documents to look at when exactly I was in supervised visits. But as a child, what I think we don't place as a paramount issue when we're thinking about supervised visits is the child's current development. You know, I don't care if the child is 8, 9, 10, 16. If that child's emotional and mental development is behind or is stuck in whatever place that they were traumatized, then a therapeutic visitation, in my opinion, as a person going, having gone through this, is always best. I also don't think the courts realize, and neither does the parenting time laws realize, that just ordering therapeutic visitation and saying, you know what, this order is entered Monday, we're going to enter or begin therapeutic visitation on Friday, there's no transition. You know, trauma happens in an instant, but that transition and the coming out of it and the healing can last a lifetime. So I'm not necessarily a big promoter of something happens, we file a motion, supervised visits, okay, now we're going to order it without having some kind of a therapeutic intervention before therapeutic supervised visits. Shouldn't a child who has been traumatized, or maybe on the other end, the court believes is in somewhat of a danger when they're with the other parent, Why should that child be once again dropped into a situation with a parent who we know can develop more and a third party who they don't know? I think, just as another idea, part of therapeutic supervision, and maybe there are therapeutic supervisors out there that require that they form a relationship with the child before bringing in the parent. Because how do I mean, and maybe this is my brain coming from the MSW program and having previously given counseling to kids, but how do I, as a therapeutic supervisor, tell the parent what the parent needs to do for the child if I don't know what the child needs based on my own observations?
I would guess, you're either giving super generic kind of counsel that's not personalized to little Johnny or little Jill. Right.
And it's not, I mean, it will help, but it's not going to be the most advantageous.
Right. And I mean, when you think of like supervised parenting time, I mean, what boxes do you have? You have kind of like, you know, you go to the center, right? You go to Appanagar or I think Mujeres Latinas or one of those city places, DuPage County Family Metro. Center. Which you're just kind of sitting in a room, I think, and there's just kind of like, let's just say safety is provided for and not much else. I don't know, a couple games. I haven't been to either of those places. Right. We certainly use sort of some of the ride along places, if you will, professional supervisors, Pat Anderson, those guys, they're pretty, they're good in the sense that right now let's just say I'm a dad who needs supervised parenting time. I can go whatever to Chuck E. Cheese's or a baseball game and have a little more fun than just sitting at the center. I don't know what the therapeutic component is there. So that's still maybe missing a little. But perhaps your solution that I honestly probably see the most rare would, is like, hey, you get the social worker therapist involved a bit, with child, and then kind of as he or she deems it appropriate, now let's sort of introduce this parent who's been troublesome. Would that be your ideal model, Jason?
Correct. Correct.
Yep. And I've seen that a few times, but yeah, I would say of those three, it's probably the rarest, sadly.
It is. Definitely. And of course, as you know, Peter, it definitely depends on the totality of what has occurred.
Right.
But when I think of therapeutic supervised visits, I don't really consider it parenting time. I consider it going to therapy with your child.
Right. Fair enough. And I'm interested, or what would, not taking aback is too strong of a statement, but right, I would think somebody who has the family law personal background that you've had, you could have gone in one of two directions, right? It could be like I'm repelled or something of this world, or I'm attracted to it. I mean, maybe I'm oversimplifying. We only have a half an hour here, but I could, right? I'm curious that you weren't repelled, but in a sense, you're now in this field. Why do you think that is? Probably a really long answer, but you know what I mean? It's like, this was awful. I'm going to go, what's the farthest thing from family law? I don't know, golf professional or something. I'm just making it up, but right.
Yeah, yeah.
But instead you're like, you're practicing family law. Hey, I want to represent kids in cases. So it's like, kind of like you want to serve people in this area. So at some level, you must, you know, right, you must have found some meaning or something that says, boy, I've got a hook here and I want to be here and not like at the opposite extreme. I'm curious, kind of.
Sure.
React.
So I met during my undergrad program. I took a couple of social work classes just as an elective, and I met a professor who I became pretty close with, and she was my clinical professor during the 2-year master's program. And also during that time, I met an attorney who has a JD MSW as well. And the way that the holistic thinking that social workers are able to do when they have clinical training, I thought and was encouraged to think that it would very much complement being a family law attorney. So I think it's a unique combination because I have half a brain in each area of knowledge, and it's a constant combat in my head. I'm going to be honest. And I was told from other attorneys who had both educations that it would be, because one is thinking more holistically and thinking about a global solution to a problem, right? But then in law, we take an issue and we focus on that issue so much that we blow up that one issue, but we're not thinking about holistic change. So going back to your question, I knew that I was always going to be an attorney, but not necessarily in this area of law. It was along the way that I kept being pulled back toward it. So like I mentioned, in high school, I got an opportunity to work at a law office where they did divorce, employment law, business law, torts, personal injury. But the majority of my work every day came from the 2 or 3 divorce lawyers. So again, getting pulled into it. And then I wrote an essay to shadow 2 attorneys at a nonprofit law firm. I won that essay contest to do that. And lo and behold, they were divorce attorneys. And a week after I shadowed there, they emailed me, you know, and said, look, we really liked you. Wondering if you would like an internship here. So again, pulled me back into it. So it just kept happening, instance after instance, where I kept getting pulled into it. And I ended up finding that it was something that I really enjoyed. I really like learning. Law is constant learning. A divorce law, as you know, is always changing. I don't necessarily like being an expert, but I like knowing a little bit about everything. And that's what, and that's what we do. But also at the same time, I'm very much a people person. I like schmoozing. And divorce attorneys, that's what we do. You know, we're litigators, we're mediators, we negotiate, we have to have people interactions. You know, as much as working at a, what do you call them? Sidley Austin or Ellis, as much as that looks great for an attorney, I couldn't only do transactional law. I have to have that interaction. So just everything about the family law is who I am.
How do you connect the dots, or what is that timeline? You graduate college. What is the, you got a master's in social work. I think you were doing some at-risk youth counseling, then getting a Juris Doctorate, graduating law school. What's kind of the time window? Was that sort of planned? Like, hey, I'm going to be a social worker, do this.
Well, see,
for Peter, 10 years, or it was like, this was.
You know, I don't like people telling me. So I'm very innovative and I don't like traditional.
Okay.
And when people tell me that this thing hasn't been done or that you can't do this, I am the kind of person that's going to say, you know what, to hell with that. I'm going to do it. Okay. So I did, when I got into undergrad, which is why you can't figure out the timeline because the timeline is blurred. I got into undergrad. Of course, that normally takes 4 years. I did it in 3. Okay. The plan was to immediately go into a JD MSW combined program. I didn't get into any of those combined programs, so I made my own. Okay. I did 1 year MSW at Loyola, and then my first year of the JD program was also my second year of the MSW. So I would do 1L year in the morning at John Marshall, now University of Illinois,
right,
in the morning. And then I take the Red Line train up to Loyola at night, Monday through Thursday, and I did the MSW. I ended up also having to take a semester off of JD program for the financial reasons. But at the end of the day, the way that I calculated, I did 9 years of school in 6.5.
So the three degrees. Okay. Got it. That's cool. So yeah, you created your own social work JD. That's pretty funny. Yeah. I
actually, believe it or not, I got a very big grant to do some research work during the MSW program, and it would have primarily paid for the entire program. However, no one told me until I told them that I wanted to begin a JD program that I could only be in the MSW program in order to get the grant. And so, of course, not too many people would turn down $20,000 for the second year of MSW program. But I said, you know what? I'm doing it anyway. So I did it. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not sure I know another. I'm sure there are a few out there. I know somebody who you know, basically has like a doctor of psychiatry or something and is a lawyer. And I know where I went to law school, there was a JD MD medical doctor program, but I don't know. I'm putting you first on my list in the JD MSW program.
I know 3 others, and
two
practice divorce and family law in the Chicago, and one is more of a therapist now. Yeah.
Okay. Hey, so let's talk about your mediation practice for a minute, or your background there. And so if I go to your website, is it PICAmediation.com? I'm not looking at it, but I think that's it.
That's correct.
It says you're focused on families of color. Tell me about that niche and kind of, you know, what it is, why you're in it. What's unique about a mediation focused on families of color versus a 48-year-old white guy like myself?
I think what makes it unique isn't necessarily anything unique to me. It's what's unique to cultures.
Okay.
So I can't necessarily, I mean, I can learn as best as I want to the culture of, and I know this is an umbrella term, sure, but the Middle Eastern the people. I can learn the culture as best as I can, but right. I can't necessarily fully comprehend it or fully empathize with it.
Right.
So, you know, in the couple of years I've been doing this in some kind of context, it became pretty relevant to me fairly quickly that divorce law, the family law, parentage in Cook County, the SA's office doing a child support and everything,
right,
does not support families of color.
Hmm.
It's very, the laws, in my opinion, are very, very traditionally written. What the judges look at are based on traditional American customs,
right,
which don't fit people of color, and in my instance, African-Americans. Mm-hmm. Now, I have the privilege of being African-American, Puerto Rican, as well as Italian. Mm-hmm. So I have a pretty diverse family. I'm able to comprehend those three. But what's unique about this mediation model is simply, well, there's a couple of things that I like to say that are unique about it, of course. But I believe number one fact is when I have two African-American parents and we're in a conference room, I make them bring, each of them, two or three pictures of their child.
Mm-hmm.
And when we're creating this agreement and there's any kind of disagreements, simply ask them, look, if you don't agree to something, the laws that we have, the judges typically do X, Y, and Z. And what I've learned doing a mediation with primarily African Americans is that when I tell them what the courts do, because what the courts do is basically a default judgment, you know, if you don't agree to this, then this is what we're doing, you know? Right. And when I tell them that, they look at me and they look at each other and they know that that's not going to work for them because of who we are. And then, for example, that's when I remind them, look, the courts weren't created for us, but the best thing that you can do is create an agreement that's going to best fit your African-American child. So far it has worked. There are other parts that are unique about the way that I do the mediation, particularly with African-Americans, but that would take quite a bit to go into.
Okay. How can the court system serve African-American clients better in their mediation program, do you think?
Well, you know, my knowledge of the Cook County mediation program is pretty basic. Like, I think most attorneys' knowledge of it is, you know, we send you there, we prepare you for mediation, and hopefully you come out with an agreement.
Right.
But even when I look at the forms that the counties use for mediation, those forms are not comprehensive enough for anybody to have an agreement, regardless of what you look like, regardless of what your ethnicity is.
Sure.
So, I mean, if the mediators aren't even talking about what makes a comprehensive agreement and we're just talking about basics, the mediation, sure, is going to work for a temporary basis. But then we all know if it's not a comprehensive agreement and it's not well written, the people are going to come back. One of the areas that I focused research on with this was when it comes to contempt proceedings in domestic relations, as well as child support, which kind of goes, you know, which kind of goes hand in hand.
Right.
Now, there, for the purposes of this comment, I'm talking about African Americans.
Okay.
We already know, and I don't get why professionals, judges, lawyers, people who research these topics, why the focus is always on the criminal justice system reform. But there's very rarely any kind of conversation about reforming what happens in the opposite end, right? A civil court. Right. There is a case in New Jersey from a couple years ago that they have held in New Jersey that in child support cases or in any kind of contempt case in domestic relations, if the result could be incarceration,
yep,
then you should have the right to an attorney for that purpose. I wrote an article about how contempt proceedings in domestic relations are very, I don't remember the professional word that I used, but for the basis of this, whitewashed. I interviewed 10 or 12 judges when I wrote this article. I wrote it before I was an attorney. That way the judges were more open with me.
Yep.
And most of those judges still on the bench today are using the word, and I phrased it around talking about cases related to HFS and child support. Sure. When I framed it in that mindset, a lot of these judges still use the word deadbeat dad,
right?
Which has the connotation in my head that most of the people using the HFS office or the H whatever office,
gotcha, right,
are people of color,
right?
But when I framed it for contempt for people that are more high asset, no judge used that word.
Hmm.
I also interviewed some SAs that I know that worked in the child support division. They let me know that the child support department, there is not very well managed. They don't get a lot of training. There's a list that goes around when you get hired of the blackest names that they have ever heard of children, which, okay, while you might not be stereotypical as an attorney, when you go into an environment that is already intoxicated with these negative values, it's hard to be any different than anyone else who's already been in the office. And then again, when it comes to this innovative piece for people of color, there's a lot of research out there that, at least in Cook County, the people who are generally more low income are people of color. So mm-hmm. We know that, we have that context, and that's unbiased research. But yet in the court system, if you don't pay your child support, then we're going to lock you up until you pay. Well, guess what? I can't pay because you locked me up. And also, I don't have a job. And yet we also know it's harder in a situations where people are low income and uneducated. Right. It's harder for people of color in that context to get jobs.
Yeah.
No, we're not helping by having prosecutors prosecute child support and lock you up in the same jail with criminals until you pay what you owe. But yet the law says, and I looked up this case, it was written by three white guys, that you have the keys to your own jail cell.
Sure.
Well, I've never had the key. Right? I've never had the key because I was born in the context where we haven't had a key to anything. We don't have an out to anything. So anyway, I can go on and on about that.
No, I mean, you're kind of preaching to the choir as some. I won't get on my soapbox too much either, because I don't want this to go on for 2 hours. We do. But
we could do it a lot of time.
I have a lot of background and history with state cases. And I mean, a couple just comments would be, Yeah, internally at our firm, yeah, I always call the state of Illinois, you know, right, the state child support case is the world's largest collection agency. Because, yeah, I mean, you can, right, you get a little behind and, well, and there's the disconnect between, frankly, the administrative child support, like collection agency, and frankly, what's going on in the court system. And they're not always the same.
They don't know.
Early in my career, I didn't understand that even myself. A lot of good friends who are state's attorney doing child support stuff, but yeah, it's definitely an early career kind of inexperienced thing.
Yep.
And, yeah, I mean, the other thing to me, just at a really top level, it's just like so much public money goes into child support collection and, you know, no public money goes into like non-financial, let's encourage parenting and not alienating a father or mother from their child, right? There's no public money on that side of thing, basically. Whereas, frankly, that whole state child support apparatus is actually funded through the federal government. It's actually part of the Social Security Act. It started in the Clinton administration,
right?
To give you some history, but so yeah, no, there's a weird. That's you know, it's a kind of
beat program and, or something like that.
I feel like yeah, I mean it's. I couldn't quote the federal statute, but I know it came in through it's like 4D of the Social Security Act that every state had to create the child support apparatus to get this federal funding. And look,
also, Peter, I need to send you my article. I have a whole article about the policing of Black parenthood and how it began from the slavery and how it has now translated all the way into child support right now.
Yeah,
there's what I think is a very clear connection.
Hey, I'll take a read. Hey, so Jason, as I try to land this plane semi-expeditiously without crashing, let me tee up a couple things. Okay. What are a couple great reasons why somebody should consider the mediation option as opposed to, you know, let's run into court and litigate? If I'm a prospective client, hey, Jason, I see you got this mediation website. Is that for me?
Three reasons, I think. Number one, it tends to be faster if everybody can come into a room and make an agreement, much faster than litigating a case. Number two, it's more cost effective. To have a mediator, right? And you don't necessarily both need attorneys to go to mediation. Right. I take cases where the two parents each pay half, although they do have the option to hire an attorney. And I think number three is just simply you're in control when you are mediating a case. When you begin to litigate, the judge that I work under tells everybody, look, when you didn't have an agreement and you walk through the doors to my courtroom, your child became mine.
Right, right. No, it's a good phrase and a great point. Any cases you say no, mediation is not the answer?
I don't think any case.
Fact scenario? Yeah, I don't think so, unless you have maybe some domestic violence or order of protection or some
right.
Something like that, I suppose.
I've even done a mediation for a parenter's case where there was an active OP. We just did it via Zoom.
Yeah. Or I think you could do like shuttle mediation a little bit too.
Right.
You,
yep.
For sure. So, all right. So I didn't even have a good answer to the when not to mediate. So, okay. I just heard go for it. And I agree. Okay. I think of the best results on cases historically. They're very few. There are a number I could think even currently where, right. You know, these guys were in mediation land versus the 6-year divorce that ended with a trial where nobody's happy.
I think mediation becomes more comprehensive for simply one reason. When you're litigating, you're worried about as a parent, what the other party's goal is or what's in their pleadings or what discovery you need. When you're litigating, you're worried about presenting the best case. You're not necessarily 100% focused on the best interest of the child. But when you're in a mediation where there's no trying to prove the other wrong, you know, or this is that and the other, that's when you can really focus on what the child needs.
Yeah. Yeah. And I feel, yeah, And it's much more like, if I feel like it's more like, hey, I'm thinking about what's like best real world. Whereas so much of, you get too far into litigation land, it's kind of, it's right that there's a relationship between what you're doing legally, sort of tactically and real world, but it's, there's a disconnect too.
Absolutely.
Hey, so Jason, what's your best piece of advice for a person facing or in the midst of divorce, and conversely, biggest mistake in one of those same situations? Thoughts?
Best piece of advice for a person facing or in the midst of divorce.
Just mediate. I mean, that's a new tagline for a brand of shoes. Just mediate.
Is it?
I don't know. That's it. I'm just making that up.
My best advice would be to get a therapist. Everybody.
Cool.
Get a therapist. I say often to my colleagues, if I was a judge, I would never have to have a hearing on whether a party to a case or a child should be ordered to go to therapy. Just ask me and I'm ordering it, because who can go through a process like this and not need additional help?
Right. No, great call. Probably. Yeah, definitely in the divorce context, family law conflict, but frankly, in our world today, probably too.
Right.
Common mistakes or something you should avoid if I'm in that same box thinking about, or in the midst of divorce, you see that, hey, this is stupid. Stop doing it.
Yeah. And I know this is a popular one, but there's always, you know, there's always a parent A's narrative, parent B's narrative, and then text messages. Stop texting about everything.
Right.
Stop putting your anger into text messages or into comments on an Instagram post, right? I think oftentimes because of the emotions that go along in this, people want to get out their anger, but they get it out in places that can be traced and used against them.
Right. Jason, super grateful to you for joining me on the pod. And hey, so who's your ideal client and where can people find you? I want to hire you for mediation, legal work, etc.
Sure. I am now at Aducius Wittenberg Canisberger. We call it DWK because it's a mouthful. 250 South Wacker. You can email me at jpica, P-I-C-A, at dwkllp.com. And my ideal client, believe it or not, my ideal client is the case with the most mental health challenges of either party or the children, because that's when I get to use the other half of my brain that I mentioned earlier. So
right. All right.
You know, for lack of better words, the nastier the better.
Got you. No, I mean, absolutely. That unique background and skill set you have, I think absolutely could bring some super value to that ideal case you just described. So Jason, thanks again for your time. And I'll see you around at the Daily Center someday.
Thank you so much. Appreciate you, Peter.
Take care.